Thank you. I would like to say a few things today about molecules. And to be honest, if somebody announces a talk about molecules for me, maybe 1 or 2 years ago, I wouldn't have been sure to actually attend the talk, because I mean, molecules sound like something which is pretty old-fashioned and it's a little bit, maybe too complicated, at least for a normal atomic physicist like me. But I sort of changed my mind, and changing my mind sort of is based on two facts. The first one is this, that if you extrapolate a few years into the future, in experimental labs, I mean, there will be cold molecules available. And I believe that there are certain properties of these molecules that are really very promising in terms of, both quantum information, also condensed matter ideas, making exotic faces and interesting models and so on. And there's nothing that I can really actually review in my talk here today, because most of these ideas are just what we're working on. And actually, many of these things that I will talk about today have not been written up yet. But let me point out the collaborators, Andrea Micheli, he's a PhD student, also Peter Rabel, Victor Steixner, Kevin Brennan is here. Okay. And Hans-Peter Büchler, he was here until, I guess, last week, and also Guido Pupillo. This was done in collaboration with these people at Harvard and at Yale. Okay, so as a starting point, let me point out that in my past, I've been interested in systems like, for example, cold atoms in optical lattices. As a matter of fact, I mean, we wrote this first paper on these Harvard models just upstairs here in 97. That's a long time ago. And I'm actually very pleased in the meantime that this has led to experimental implementations where people have in the lab now constructed Harvard models and constructed strongly interacting systems, studied quantum phase transitions. And today these things are kind of an industry, I would almost say, that people write down these Harvard models and talk about cold atom implementations and so on. We'll see afterwards in polar molecules, we can also do optical lattices, but we can do actually much more. Yeah? The second thing that has been close to my heart has been trapped ions, and actually crystals, Wigner crystals of trapped ions. Some of you might know that we had some ideas how to do quantum computing with trapped ions, and again, there's been enormous experimental progress along these lines just over the last few years, and realizing some of these ideas and far beyond. You will afterwards see that we can also do crystals with these polar molecules over here. Then, of course, there's cavity QED. We'll afterwards also do cavity QED here with these polar molecules, though in a somewhat different form. And, these things can also, there's been a lot of quantum information with atomic ensembles. We can also think about molecular ensembles over here. So all of these features here seem to be combined now in a single system, which is these polar molecules. And let me point out what the unique features are and features that we would like to use afterwards. The features are the following ones. If I go to a polar molecule, I think of this as being a diatomic molecule. I mean, there's two different species tied together to a molecule. And because of the charge imbalance, there will be a dipole moment. This dipole moment here can be significant. And the point is, of course, that the dipole moment is linked to the rotation. There will be a rotational excitation spectrum. And this leads to the fact that this dipole moment, for example, docks very strongly to microwave fields. So we not only have optical excitations, we also have microwave field excitations, and we even have a combination of these two. So this strong coupling to optical as well as to microwave fields then leads immediately to ideas that we can both talk about optical and microwave trapping and cooling. We can talk about cavity QED in the sense of a strong coupling limit here. We can talk about spontaneous emission, for example, from the excited optical state. But because this is microwave field, these rotational excitations, they essentially have no spontaneous emission, but we can engineer, if you want, spontaneous emission, for example, for some cooling purposes. And this, at the end, leads to, for example, possibilities of interfacing solid-state qubits and also AMO qubits. I consider this to be actually the only system that I know at the moment there are ideas like interfacing AMO and solid-state systems, in my opinion, really works a priori. And I will, at the end of my talk, mention some of these things briefly. And then there's some other interesting ideas here that are, again, intrinsically linked to this electric dipole moment, which is the possibility of seeing superfluid crystalline phase transitions. This is the first order phase transition where one sort of builds self-assembled lattices, which by themselves I find are very important. So I see a potential here to make new kind of lattices, but now with polar molecules, that could be very interesting in a much broader context. And we're just working on these things right now, so we'll at the end, or in the middle of my talk more, give you some brief summary of these ideas at least. Okay, I should maybe start out by telling you a few things about polar molecule, sort of basic features, about rotation spectra, spins, and how to encode qubits, sort of, and about dipole-dipole interactions on all of these things, because this will be the building block afterwards of what we want to actually achieve. So the first statement I want to make is this, that cold polar molecules will exist in the lab in a few years. And there's essentially two routes of achieving these very cold polar molecules in the lab. One is by photo association, and the other one by buffer gas cooling. They are sort of competing with each other. There's this very large community out there that does Bose-Einstein condensation with cold atoms. They have now many, many labs that have realized BEC. And of course, many of these groups at the moment switch over to study problems like having two species Bose-Einstein condensates. And to understand what the photo association essentially does is this, that suppose that you know, in one of these experiments, having two species, you build in an optic lattice, say, a mod insulator state. So you have one green atom here, a red atom over here. And if I plot the corresponding potential curve, this is an internuclear curve, this is a Born-Oppenheimer curve, sort of these two atoms sitting in the lowest state here of this optical potential would amount essentially to having an occupation up here. This is sort of like two free atoms that are sort of confined by this single potential well. And then what you can try to do is to go in with the laser and take this energy out, and hopefully you get strong coupling to go all the way to the electronic and also vibrational ground state down here. This is photo association. Of course, this depends on a lot of details. The question is, I mean, how strong is this coupling for going down here? It seems that for some of these heteronuclear molecules, one is somehow lucky, and one gets appreciable matrix elements, and I think there will be a race now for the next few years coming, by people really sort of build lasers in order to do this in a stimulated way. There have been some experiments already along these lines, but this was not induced by a laser, but by spontaneous emission going down here. But this is something that will come. So this is a way of sort of going from two species BC all the way down here to molecules. So sort of build a mod insulator is the ideal version, do a photo association, and then build your molecules. And then you can see what you have. You already have a mod insulator of maybe polar molecules, you know, if this is a two species stuff.
Are there principles that tell you one molecule is a good candidate for this, or one has to use a detail?
Well, the first thing I have to say that from the fact that you want to do a BEC at the beginning, this limits at the moment these kind of atoms significantly. They are not the most interesting one. I will afterwards, you know, mention molecules that cannot be cooled in this way, because calcium at the moment has no condensate and so on. So the list of molecules that are very interesting does not necessarily coincide with the ones that they could actually do easily. So then the numbers don't look so good, but I mean, you know, there are so many molecules out there that, you know, the hope is that, okay. And the second approach would be a buffer gas cooling that would be sort of independent of using any lasers. And again, there has been, John Doyle in particular and also Dave DeMille have been working on this idea. So there's a lot of progress also here, but there's a competition between these two kind of approaches. Okay, what the model that we would like to study at the very end really comes down to is a rigid rotor. Think now that we have prepared now an electronic ground state and a vibration ground state, and we talk about rotational excitations. So this is a rigid rotor. This thing can rotate in space, and it has a certain dipole moment d. So a rigid rotor is a very trivial excitation spectrum, but it has some properties that I really like here, which is first of all the following one. It is an unharmonic spectrum, as you can see here. Yeah? So in this sense, it will be very easy to put qubits in, and you also can see that the vibrational excitation spectrum, so the typical numbers are maybe something like 10 or 20 gigahertz. This has a very strong dipole moment up here, a few dBi. So the coupling and the coupling to microwave fields here will be really strong. And at the end, I mean, this dipole moment, this will be the game to be played. And you can see these frequencies, I mean, these microwave frequencies are really very convenient. So if I want to summarize that, I would say we have very large electric dipole moment, but note that the ground state by itself has no dipole moment. You know, the dipole moment only emerges if you couple this thing to the excited state. So if I put an electric field down, I can sort of mix an excited state here and then induce in a dipole moment is an induced dipole moment. But in a microwave radiation, of course, you would see this dipole matrix element directly for this 10 or 20 gigahertz coupling here. The spectrum is unharmonic, so you don't have these problems of putting qubits like in the case of a harmonic oscillator. And what I really like is the fact that in contrast to all of the atomic physics that we normally do with optical excitations, the excited state emission down here is essentially negligible. You know, it's maybe something like 10 to the minus 3 hertz. So you can really think about using all of these excited states that you have in these rotation excitations here for something to do your state engineering, whatever you want to do. So excited states are usable, and you can actually put, you know, the wave functions over here in these states, and this will afterwards be quite important when we do this design of some of these Hamiltonians. Okay, so this is sort of the most simple version, just a rigid rotor that I've just explained. Now you can add certain structure, because at the end what we really want is we would like to have spin in these electrons. So think of a situation now where we are adding spin. So there's the rotational excitation, but there may be some outer electron. I will afterwards give you an example that has also now spin. The spin can point up and the spin can point down. And so instead of having a single state which is down here, now you got a degenerate ground state. You know, one of them is pointing up and the other one is down. It's very clear what we want to do. At the end, we would like to put a spin qubit over here. But you can also see a second feature that once I start to add spin to this whole game, then you can see there will be a splitting in the excited state. This splitting is what we call a spin rotation splitting. If I write down a Hamiltonian, there's a term n. This is this angular momentum is now coupled to the spin. And the way of thinking about it, at least from an atomic physics point of view, is this. If I go to an alkali atom, in the excited state, I have a spin orbit coupling. There's a fine structure resulting from this thing. This is very similar. You're coupling here the spin to the rotation. So this is like spin orbit coupling, but the orbit now is, so to say, the rotation of the molecule. To give you sort of a feeling for the scale, this thing is maybe something like 10 gigahertz, as you said. The separations for molecules that I look at afterwards, it may be something like 60 megahertz. So this sort of looks like, if you want to say that, you know, like an alkali atom for me, you know, but it's sort of squashed down. Alkali atoms, this would be an optical frequency, this would be fine structure, and for me this is now sort of, you know, squashed down, and the scale is now 10 gigahertz here, and this is maybe 60 megahertz, so it's like an alkali atom, you know, but in a completely different scale, and of course we don't have any spontaneous emission from these excited states. So all of my thinking about atoms can be sort of recycled when I see that, but I'm allowed to play more games than before. Now, if you want to put a qubit, of course, you might put like, two states over here. This is anharmonic. This works very well. But of course, at the end, you really would like to have a spin qubit like we have over here. You might have, you know, an electron spin up or down here and store it over there. And I said before that this looks like an alkali atom. Now, so I'm back to atomic physics, but so I'm able to recycle ideas that one had, you know, previously, but in a somewhat different setting over here. The second remark that I want to make about molecules is this, that of course these dipole moments that we have, in particular, for example, think of an excited state here, these molecules, they can be very large. They are electric dipole moment, like not what we normally have in the case of atoms, but these would be magnetic dipole moments, and they're first of all long range, they have an angular dependence, in the sense that a situation like this is repulsive, and a situation like this would be attractive. And they are relatively strong. They are really strong on the scale what we normally used to from the cold atom work. So this means that these interactions are not only long range in an optical lattice. This can induce, for example, some off-site interactions. But also in terms of the temperature requirements, this could be much better than all of whatever we do in the case of atoms. And so now we are already point where I can sort of indicate what at the end we would like to do when we engineer, for example, some complicated maybe spin-spin interactions, for example, in some, for example, optical lattice. You can see that the tools that we have available. First of all, if I take two molecules and, for example, I hold them in two separate places, like, for example, in an optical lattice, I can ask questions like, you know, I'm putting a spin in the ground state here and a spin in the ground state. So these are two molecules sitting there. Each of them has a spin. And the rotation quantum number in this case is zero. But now you can ask, okay, I'm holding them a certain distance. I would like to induce a certain interaction between them. And at the end, what we will ask is this, that you will sort of specify an interaction between these spins for me over even over a given distance. And then in principle, we can argue that we can engineer a spin-spin interaction, where we not only specify what kind of interaction we want, but maybe also what the corresponding range is, and hopefully also with a significant coupling, or in coupling which is hopefully much larger than what we normally have in atomic physics. But the physics behind it is just combining what I said before. You have your spin, which is down here. You can see that we can couple the spin, you know, to the rotation by the spin-rotation coupling. Sort of the molecule does this thing automatically for you. So the spin will be coupled to rotation. But what is rotation? Rotation is essentially where your dipole moment will point. Okay? Now, so in this sense, we are coupling the spin to the dipole moment, but the dipole moment interacts, because it is a very strong electric dipole moment, can interact over a distance. It is long range. It is actually quite strong. And it even has some angular dependence. And so by combining here microwave excitation up here in the form that we have to specify, that adding this electric dipole, long range dipolar interactions here, the question is, by doing these things properly, like shining in certain frequencies with the microwave light, can we engineer effective spin-spin interactions down here that are non-trivial? And I will show you afterwards that we have some examples where we believe that that we can actually do that. So it's just combining these building blocks that I've outlined before. Okay, if you want to know why you never wanted to work on molecules, look at the following slides. Okay. You know, this is the real life for molecular spectra. Okay, you can look at all of these numbers, very nice. I'm not trying to explain it because probably I don't understand enough. You could sort of see that we are cycling in now here in this molecular spectra on the lowest vibrational level. So we want like to be all the way down here on the top. We want to see the rotational excitation. So it's really sort of focusing in here. And for example, strontium oxide is one of these molecules that would be an example. And it's really too bad that we cannot make these molecules from a two species, both Einstein condensate. But to give you the numbers, you know, this has about, say, 20 gigahertz rotational excitations here. So this is this rigid rotor spectrum that I pointed out before. And in the 1950s, I guess people did a lot of microwave spectroscopy on these things, so most of these things are quite well known. To give you a second sort of real-world example of a molecule that I really somehow like in this context, it's the one of calcium fluoride. Yeah? And I just want to point out to you what the basic physics is behind this thing, because this is sort of underlying then a lot of this thinking, and this is at the end sort of a realization of the kind of spin rotation coupling that we talked about before. If I give you a molecule like calcium and fluoride, I mean, the fluor atom essentially would like to grab one of these two outer electrons that you have here from the calcium, and this will walk over. And then there will be one electron left over here that becomes sort of an electron that will essentially delocalize over this whole molecule. So you can see that we have here two features. First of all, you have here a very strong electric dipole moment. That's exactly what we wanted to have before. But the second feature is also that we have one single electron which is now outside. And you can think of this like being an alkali atom where you can do your optical excitation. So everything that you know from alkali atoms about optical excitations, about optical lattices, all of these things reapplies. But at the same time, we also have now this benefit of having this very strong electric dipole moment with these rotations that we would like to manipulate. So that's a typical example where we have sort of two handles. It talks to optical radiation, optical lattices, and all of these things are possible. But it also talks very strongly with an electric dipole moment to microwave radiation. Of course, life then becomes complicated. You can sort of, you know, start to write down different Hamiltonians. This would be just the rotor. Then you would add maybe spin rotation coupling over here. The spectrum becomes more complicated. Then, of course, this thing also has hyperfine structure. And then you can see this mess emerging over here. And then you might say, well, that's too complicated for what we want. But if you really progress here, you can see that we have the hyperfine splitting down here. Again, very similar to what we know from the alkaline atoms. It's just a different scale. But now we can use microwave radiations to drive, for example, say, a clock transition here and all of these things like we know it in the case of the atoms. So all of our thinking of atomic physics can be recycled. You can just replace the word microwave by optical radiation by microwave radiation. And, you know, this would be hyperfine spin qubit and all of these things like where people build atomic clocks and so on. So for me, if I summarize that, is I'm very glad to see that as a quantum optics theorist, you know, the only thing I can sort of understand are two and three level systems. Molecules are two and three level systems. So at this point, we are in the business, and now we can start thinking what to do with them. Okay, so let me now summarize that we have three projects that we are working on at the moment. I mean, some of them are sort of finished or half finished, and some other ones are sort of just in the process of, you know, what we're working on right now. And I think what I should do is, first of all, to give you a brief kind of a sneak preview of these ideas, just to point out sort of examples and ideas, what you can do with these things in terms of new stuff. And then we can enter a more detailed discussion and then... No, let's see how we're doing with time. Okay, of course, optical lattices is one very clear thing, and I pointed out before, we can put, of course, polar molecules inside of an optical lattice. And so what you normally do in the case of atoms, but you can also do it with molecules, is that we put in atoms or a molecule now that has, for example, this spin qubit in the ground state. And then we can ask ourselves, it doesn't have to be a square lattice, that we would like to engineer some very complicated spin lattice Hamiltonian. So the game to be played is this, that you specify a complicated Hamiltonian, okay? And then we think if by the means that we have available, we can actually realize this Hamiltonian on this optical lattice. So this would be given by optical lattice by this laser, standing light wave. And then this engineering of this Hamiltonian, we would like to do them, for example, using this microwave spin rotation coupling, dipole interactions, all of these things. And sort of as a footnote, let me also point out that the same kind of a thinking, I'll talk about spin lattice models really here, also applies to Hubbard models. There's a possibility here to repeat the Hubbard physics that we know so well with atoms, but adding now dipolar interactions, of course, that we have hopping from side to side, but you can also induce relatively large off-site couplings here. And so this, I think, is quite interesting from the Hubbard point of view, that you have off-site couplings that can be even relatively strong. So if you ask me what kind of models, of course, maybe models like that sound very familiar, you know, this Kidaev model, but also models like these protected quantum memory models where you want very strange couplings like this anisotropic XX coupling along these lines and a ZZ coupling that goes down here. These would be candidates, but in principle, I mean, we want to be open. So if there's an interesting spin lattice model out there, we can ask ourselves, can we engineer these kind of models that we're writing down here by the means that we have available? This is sort of one project, and the answer is that we know how to do some of these things. You can see here we have an optical lattice, and now we're putting these polar molecules over here, and then this way of engineering spin-spin interaction comes in, maybe introducing these anisotropic spins like indicated down here. And in the case of this Kidaev model, it becomes a little bit more complicated. I guess that explaining this by itself would probably fill a whole talk, so I'll say a few words about that, but I'll mainly explain this model and then say, okay, this is more complicated, but sort of it follows the same ideas over here. So this is a paper that will come out in Nature Physics in May, together with Kevin Brennan, who is here. And if you ask me what we're doing here, sort of we are playing the atomic physics game here, and the molecular physics game of trying to construct with these optical lattices here virtual quantum materials. Sort of, you know, you specify the material by writing down a Hamiltonian, and we think about implementing these things by switching on appropriate microwave fields and so on, and some optical fields, to really construct lattices and materials, and they don't have to be small. I mean, they can even be quite large. Yeah? So something like maybe 60-60 or maybe 100 by 100 lattice is experimentally quite easily feasible, at least in terms of the numbers. Yeah? And so in this sense, you specify the Hamiltonian, and we would know in principle what kind of fields that we want to apply in order to engineer that. So it's sort of a playground that we have these materials available that we can maybe at the end then manipulate in some way to see interesting stuff, like maybe some interesting excitations and so on. Sort of a second project.
You're allowed to know this. I mean, you also have next to you.
Yes, at the end, in principle, yes, that's right. It will be a little bit weaker, but basically you can specify the anisotropy of the spin interactions. You will be able to specify the range. I mean, I'm sort of saying this now a little bit like black-white, okay? In reality, I mean, you know, some things are easier. I believe them, and then sort of, you know, my fidelity in believing these things gradually decreases if you demand more and more and more. But in principle, yes. That's right. So if I go longer range, then of course, if you ask a very strong coupling of a long range, then I'm in trouble. Yeah. But I mean, nearest neighbor. I mean, the point is really much more that if I have 1/r³, I'm actually quite worried that I might induce next to nearest neighbor coupling that I actually don't want. Okay. But we will afterwards see that we know how to switch them off. Yeah. So we'll switch them off. That's right. I'm going to tell you in 5 minutes. Okay. Okay, this was sort of project number one, okay, and to give you an idea of what we're working on at the moment and what literally at the moment I would say is this, that I would like to find a replacement for optical lattices. And the reason is, first of all, that there seems to be too many people working on optical lattices, so you want to do something else. But the second point is also that I believe that there would be a lot of interest, for example, to see a kind of a crystalline phase in some of these, for example, molecular systems or maybe even atomic systems. And my hope has always been, or my big complaint about optical lattices has always been that an optical lattice really has the problem that that the wavelengths of the light, you know, specifies what the distance is. And the corresponding energy scales that come out are actually pretty tiny. And so the only way that we beat it in atomic physics is that we go to very low temperatures and we have very long coherence times and so on. But the problem is really that an optical lattice is too large. So the question is, can we build lattices that are not induced by an external periodic field, but that are sort of self-assembled lattices in a way? And I think that we know how to do it. And actually, these polar molecules is one example. And it sort of goes like this, that if I specify trapping potential, and it's important I do these things in a pancake configuration. Suppose that I induce now dipole moments that go like this, they will repel each other. Yeah? And then, of course, depending on what the repulsion is and depending how strong I have my confinement over here, and particularly also how strong I'm able to confine these things into kind of this kind of a pancake configuration here, then I'm able to get, for example, triangular lattices here. And then, of course, the whole game starts again. We might put little spins, you know, inside in these states and then think about engineering. The important point will be that we believe that we can build lattices that are much smaller than an optical wavelength, you know, maybe something like 100 nanometers distance, maybe even smaller. And this is long before these molecules really start to overlap and sort of touch each other here. And so I think that this is a very interesting way to sort of make self-assembled lattices in atomic and molecular physics as a new kind of a lattice structure. And so instead of having, for example, the superfluids that we normally have, bosons and condensates, there will be a phase transition here. If you switch on these dipoles here stronger and stronger, and at the end you get the lattice structure that can either be in a homogeneous system, this triangular lattice, or there can be a shell structure here and so on. And this, well, if you start from the DCs that we had at the very beginning, you would essentially get the zero temperature at the very beginning anyway. And so the temperatures that people will construct at the moment, with these buffer guards cooling, they're far away. But this way of doing the mod insulator and so on would right away essentially give it a zero temperature of all of these things. So temperature, I guess, will not be an issue, at least.
But if to remove overlap, how to be even show its theorem that crystal cannot be organized by Coulomb interaction only?
Well, this will be a combination of, first of all, no, the way that I explained it here is this, that we have dipolar interactions, and we have an external trap, you know, that they will simply repel each other, and they would like to do something like that. And we have to prevent these things by external traps, and we have to work out exactly what the parameters are for doing that. Of course, if I go close and close, I want to make a smaller and smaller crystal, my requirements for the confinement, for example, go up, and we have to ask ourselves, can we do these things in a real system? And I will argue at the end that we can. There's many ways of doing that. Actually, what we're doing at the moment is something more interesting than I've plotted here. We're asking ourselves the following question. You know, if you talk about atoms or also molecules that interact with each other, you know, it is the molecular potential which is sort of, you know, specifies what the interactions are. And why do we see a bose-Einstein condensate and not a crystal in the case of atoms? It's simply that you got some weakly attractive potential, and we can model these things in terms of a scattering length. Yeah? So what we're asking ourselves is that, can we modify the interatomic or intermolecular potential externally by our tricks, by using microwave or laser, whatever, in order to engineer interesting potentials that, instead of being attractive, are at least in the outer part, which is relevant here for the distances, repulsive. And so we're engineering potentials, you know, to get them some interesting many-body phases. This is the, you know, the part that we're doing here. And this dipolar is just really one part. Yeah? And there's a final part over here, a paper that we are essentially ready to submit. This has so many authors and sort of, you know, very, very famous people on that it's hard to converge. Where we are doing the following things with this Yale and also Harvard people. I've told you before that if I give you a cold cloud of molecules, of polar molecules, and they don't have to be condensed. I mean, there can be a thermal cloud, okay, but we want maybe something like a microkelvin would be great, but a millikelvin would also be sufficient. But it's not too far away from what some of these groups, you know, might be able to do even with a buffer guard cooling. And suppose that we put a molecular cloud over here. I'm claiming that this molecular cloud with the spin qubit that we have could even, you might store what we call an ensemble qubit in there, that in the whole cloud, you're able to store a qubit. I will tell you afterwards how this works. But sort of a scheme that we have here is now sort of combining AMO physics. We are sort of trying to construct like a kind of a slow hard disk, if you want, for a solid-state quantum processor. Okay. So to explain these things in a few words, there's been this enormous progress, for example, it's done in the group by Rob Schrillkopf and Steve Gerwin at Yale, where they talk about what they call circuit cavity QED. They have a strip line cavity, it's essentially coaxial cable. This is a fantastic resonator, and they put in a Cooper Bear box. And the Cooper Bear box is like a two-level system. So they can do cavity QED and strong coupling cavity QED in the systems. But they're essentially limited at the moment by the fact that these Cooper Bear boxes, when it comes to decoherence, there's all of these material problems, are not the greatest materials of all. I mean, it becomes a material problem, and this is the problem is really, I mean, defacing these Cooper Bear boxes. What we are now saying is this, that you can couple, of course, I mean, the frequencies of these strip line cavities is something like maybe 10 gigahertz. And 10 gigahertz now sounds to us very familiar, because we just mentioned before that if I give you a polar molecule, it has a strong electric dipole, then it really likes to doctor this microwave radiation here. And by not only taking a single polar molecule, but by taking a whole ensemble, we can very easily, for very conservative numbers in terms of trapping, and can float this molecular cloud maybe 10 micrometers above the strip line cavity, we can have the qubit, which is stored in the ensemble here, you know, in a very strong coupling to the cavity mode. And so in this sense, you can have sort of kind of a hybrid quantum processor, if you want to call it like that, where you can, for example, you know, swap photons that you have over here that you might manipulate with a Cooper Bear box on a very short time scale, and then sort of put it in memory here, and vice versa. So this becomes sort of the quantum memory here for a solid state device. And you're just writing at the moment a paper with these people, and maybe at the end I have a little bit of time to talk about that, but probably not. If somebody's interested to talk to me about this, then I'll be glad to do it. And what I really like is the fact that we not only have now between these qubits over here a deterministic entanglement that uses the Cooper Bear box as a nonlinearity in the strip line cavity, we also have a way of, for example, an optical readout, because we have access to optics, so we have finally, so to say, quantum communication and the optics that is flying qubits sort of interconnected, for example, with superconducting qubits that we have living here, or by this kind of a hybrid device that so I explained.
Very experimental paper.
Which one? This one here?
The one with all the authors.
Ah, no, this is the moment. It's a theoretical paper. But, you know, the fact that there's actually quite a lot of experimentalists here, I mean, I had this idea of doing that when I visited Rob Schrillkopf at Yale last year, and, you know, then seeing him and hearing him complain about these things, but it's, you know, defacing here, and then talking to Dave DeMille on the same day that has these polar molecules, the connection was then quite obvious to be made. And so we worked out all of these things. Actually, the major part of working this thing out is you have to study the defacing of this thermal molecular gas, and this is sort of a nasty problem, but this took about 99% of our work in order to understand these things, and it's not a fun problem, but yeah. Okay, so let me say a few words about these spin models of optical lattice. As I said before, that we would like to engineer this Hamiltonian here, that we essentially specify. And this idea, to summarize again, was that we have our spin qubits down here, microwave, it docks, you're sort of converting spin to rotation, rotation is dipole moment, and then you ask yourself how these things couple, and we want to engineer some interaction down here, what I explained before. So at this point, of course, the this quite boring part starts, where you have to look at the eigenspectrum of these two coupled rigid rotors that dock to each other by dipole-dipole interactions. And you diagonalize this Hamiltonian for a given distance. So this is the distance between these molecules over here. And you can see if I take a very large distance out here, this is my rotational excitation spectrum. I'm sort of using atomic notation here, but I think it's not too confusing. This would be two molecules in their rotational ground state, isotropic. This is my 10 gigahertz going up. Now one of these molecules is excited. Here both of them are excited to the first excited rotational state. And if I start moving in and sort of, you know, take these molecules and I grab them with my optical lattice and I start moving these things closer and closer and closer, what will happen is this. It will see, of course, the dipole-dipole interactions being switched on. This is dipole-dipole. This is one of our cube that we are switching on here. This is the coupling between the S and the P state, kind of this flip-flop that you have. and then we're sort of walking in, the distance gets larger. So with an optical lattice, we are sort of, you know, able to take particles and put them at a certain position here, and this can sort of walk in at least over a certain range given by the optical wavelength. If you would take this thing by itself, which at the moment has no spin rotation coupling, and it would just sort of focus in on this part, this would be these very familiar curves that we have from molecular physics, depending on these different alignments here relative to this internuclear axis. And I should also mention that the ground state, of course, this excited state is 1/r³. The ground state down here, of course, has the familiar C6 coefficient, so it's just 1/r₆, but this is, of course, weakly attractive, like in the case of atoms. If you only had molecules down here, you might actually be able to describe it by scattering lengths. The scattering lengths, because of these strong dipole interactions, would be a factor larger than in the case of the atoms. But what we really want to do is this, you should not forget that, is this, that we want to look at spin-spin couplings that we want. So let me sort of redo this whole way of thinking now by including the spin rotation splitting. So if I'm out here very far distances, this is again by two rotors in the ground state. Now I go to the excited state, and now I can see the splitting, what in atomic notation you might call 3/2 and 1/2 over here, and this would be the spin rotation splitting. Okay? So, but now you can see that if I start walking into closer and closer distances here, there will be a competition between the dipolar interactions. These are the ones that are this mu squared divided by r³, and at the same time, the spin rotation coupling. So at this point, the dipolar interactions start to compete with your spin rotation coupling that caused for individual molecules this large splitting that we had out here. And if you again focus in on this part, you can see this really big mess of curves over here. I think we should not try to spend really time explaining all of these quantum numbers that are here. But the only point is this, that you see these things coming in, and at one point you get this complete mess of all of these spaghetti curves over here, and you get all of these quantum numbers. The message behind all of this is now the following. This is sort of focusing in now into this part here. Suppose that now that I give you two molecules and we can put them a certain distance, okay? So you fix the distance and you go to some place over here, wherever it might be. And you can change this by your optical lattice. I can put on now a microwave field, okay, that sort of, you know, walks all the way down. This is a microwave, this is my 10 gigahertz, and this is sort of the line now shifted up here. I can put on a microwave field that sort of, you know, is now closely resonant with one of these excited states over here. And the message behind this plot is now the following. Depending with the microwave where I tune, you know, to these different states that we have here specified by these different quantum numbers, at the end of the day, this thing translates into a certain kind of a spin-spin coupling for the ground state. Okay? So the first message is this. By tuning with a microwave field close to one of these resonances over here, we can select a certain spin texture for the coupling of the two spins in the ground states. And this can be highly non-trivial. As a matter of fact, if I just, you know, if I call the body axis connecting the two molecules and the x-axis, you can see that the coupling will depend, you know, this is spin-spin coupling. So for example, if I go to the state 2g, I essentially get a pure x-x coupling, which is along the line connecting the two molecules. So at this point, you can already see that when we want to do an anisotropic spin model, which is XX in one direction and a ZZ coupling in the other direction, I mean, this is what you get exactly at this point, because, you know, this is the X-axis defined by the body axis connecting the two molecules over here. And so this is the first message here. By tuning microwave radiation, you know, at the given distance here, the one close to one of these levels, you induce spin-spin couplings that you can sort of select, you know, I mean, take this list over here, and you can select the corresponding spin texture that you want, like this one over here. And this depends, it's relative to the molecular axis. So if you change your orientation in space, what is XX over here would be a sigma C over here, this one, okay? So this is the first lesson to be learned from that. Now, let me specify two more things that sort of come out immediately from this picture, which is the following one over here. Maybe we should not... let me explain first here, then go back to the other one. If I take now a lattice, I've just explained to you how, for example, to get an XX coupling here while at the same time getting a ZZ coupling over here. The other question that you will ask now is this: how do we engineer the range of the interaction? Of course, if you have an XX coupling over here and was something like in 1/r³, there may be an appreciable coupling also by the next one. But the reason why this doesn't happen and why, so to say, we can also engineer the range of the interaction is that If I give you on a square lattice two neighbors, you know, the amount being a certain distance over here, and then by putting the microwave I coupled over here, if I take something which is the next neighbor, okay, then I'm sort of out here, you know, I'm docking with my microwave field to nothing. So in this sense we get an effective range, and you can even design in this sense the range of the interaction if you want to. So we can switch it on. And the last point I would like to make clear is also this, that well, if you really have some courage, you might not only put in a single microwave field, but you might put in you know, a few. And then you can start to weight these kind of spin textures that you have here and make superpositions of them, coherent superpositions, to sort of engineer and Hamiltonian that may be of interest. But the important point is really that we get that this thing has to be seen relative to the internuclear axis, to this body axis connecting these two molecules here. The story is actually much more complicated than I sort of presented over here, because there's a lot of molecular physics, and thanks God there's no molecular expert in the audience, because then real discussions would start. So it's a simple, I'm sort of simplifying a little bit here, but you sort of get the point. So the first point was that we can engineer the spin texture. Statement number two is this, that we can choose the range of the interaction for the given spin texture. So you might even say that maybe I would like to have a different coupling over here, and you specify what it is, and I put in the microwave field, you know, for this distance in order to engineer the corresponding interactions. And feature number three is that with a multi-frequency field, we can add things up. And so I consider this to be a toolbox for engineering complicated lattice models. I mean, the way that we discussed it, it's obvious how to do these things in 2D. So doing something like this Joffe or Feigelman model becomes possible. But it can also be done for the Kitaev model here. The story behind this is much more complicated, and I think that this would really fill a talk by itself. Actually, it might be a nice idea to ask Gavin next week to give a short qualitative summary, because at the end he was the one who came up with a very specific, you know, scheme that we had behind this, given all of these toolbox. So our claim is really that we know, at least in principle, how to do a Kitaev model, this Kitaev 2005 model, on the lattice to realize a honeycomb lattice. And the statement is that with sort of numbers that are not completely unreasonable, we get exactly the coupling specified, you know, by the CZ, XX, and the YY. And there are some remaining couplings that are left over. Okay, sort of couplings that are, you know, small perturbations, because they are not completely eliminated. You know, they are sort of indicated in this picture here that you might have. And, you know, these finite, the other remaining couplings that we have, you know, would be sort of the order, I think it's something like a few percent down. So you have a Kitaev model, but the perturbations are maybe sort of the design errors, if you want, are in the order of about a few percent. Now, Andrea and also Gavin have done diagonalizations of this model on a very few sites here, or plaquettes. And they have, it seems like that the interesting phase in the Kitaev model is not really perturbed by this maybe 2% errors that you do over here. So in this sense, it seems to be stable. So this may be a sort of a quantum optics or atomic physics point of view, or molecular, I should now say. I'm not used to the word molecule yet somehow. To engineer sort of these quantum materials that might be the basis or starting point of playing games, like, you know, then seeing maybe anions and then anion interferometry and so on. Okay, I've told you the basic idea, so I would like to use maybe the last now 10 minutes or 15 minutes that I have here to tell you a little bit more about this idea we're working on right now, which is that we would like to have new kind of crystals. Okay, I would like to replace the optical lattice. First, as I said before, because too many people are working on these things right now. But also because I believe that there may be a very interesting way to maybe make some new kind of lattices in atomic physics, sort of self-assembled lattices, as opposed to the one that we prescribe externally with polar molecules. But it can actually also be done with atoms. And people involved are sort of listed down here. So I want to tell you what the ideas are behind that. This is more like a list of giving, you know, sort of a kind of a vision, what I believe, you know, we might be able to do. And it's actually quite a long list. But experimentally, I believe that this is not completely unrealistic, what I'm talking about. So this may really be sort of a guideline for these coming developments, which at the very end will then sort of connect back to this condensed matter physics. So we are constructing new lattices for these ideas. Okay. to sort of summarize briefly what I said before, we would like to engineer long-range repulsive interactions between atoms or molecules. For example, in the form of maybe in one of R cube. This is what we talked before. If I give you a polar molecule and I align it in an external electric field, and this thing is in a plane, that's very important, there will be repulsive one of R cube interactions. And sort of, you know, they are sort of counterbalanced by a trap that we put down from the outside. And if I make this dipole moment very, very weak, of course, I will get here a BEC, like a superfluid, and there will be a first-order quantum phase transition at zero temperature that goes over into this crystalline phase where you would form sort of lattices here. And this is a Monte Carlo simulation that was done by Guido Bobillo, based on a code, then this famous worm algorithm by Prokofiev and actually Svistinov. They've written a new version of this thing, and we're allowed to use this code. This sort of indicates qualitatively what's happening. This would be the superfluid, you know, and this would be the shell structure in the case of a very small number of molecules sort of emerging, that in the case of a larger system, of course, would be a triangular lattice. So we will get, of course, triangular lattices out.
What are the black dots and what's the red thing?
The red thing is sort of you take a Monte Carlo and you follow this thing in time, you know, in time under quotes, and then you plot this thing and you sort of see that there's shell structures forming. And this is the last configuration. And you can see from this last configuration, if you just put the dots here, that they really form a crystalline structure here. Yeah? But the shells might be rotating relative to each other, and, you know, there can be sort of different kind of meltings, like, you know, they can align relative to each other, then there can be sort of melting within a shell, and then finally this radial shell sort of melt together to form then something like a superfluid, so there can be different steps of this phase transition. It's a physics which is somehow similar to what people did when they discussed Wigner crystals in a case with electrons, in a case of, for example, large quantum dots. But you will see now that actually there's an important difference because we don't have the Coulomb potential. You know, this will be essential property in studying this whole system, because this will allow us to form lattices at high densities, which is just the opposite of what they have in the Coulomb case. To sort of put the wave function on the indicator, this would be a Grof-Spiderevsky wave function, where all of these molecules sort of, you know, live or share the same wave function, form a microscopic quantum wave function. Crystalline, in this sense, would mean that we're looking at the situation where you have a distance between this thing, that's your lattice, and they have very small oscillations around it. And there will be some delta U sort of specifying what the amplitude of these oscillations are. And there will be the Lindemann criterion that tells you at what point you will melt. So if you, you know, make this coupling sort of this quantum fluctuations, or, you know, maybe also to the temperature. In our case, it's always quantum fluctuation. Make this larger and larger. Once these things start to overlap, they discover that they are bosons or fermions. And this is, of course, the point in the sense of this Lindemann criterion, where you go over here to the left-hand side. Okay, question in atomic physics or molecular physics is how to build, prepare, and measure these things and properties, and of course, why also from an atomic physics point of view. And I see in particular in the answering the why, a lot of very interesting applications this is interesting in its own right, because nobody has seen a crystal with these polar molecules. That would be an interesting new phase to study. But I see a lot of interesting applications where we build on forming these lattices, and I said before, the distance between them can be actually quite small. Okay, let me point out the important difference between these crystals that we have here and the case of the ions. If I talk about trapped ions, I have a 1 over R interaction, this is Coulomb, and I have charge E squared. Note that the charge obviously is fixed, okay? If I compare this with the case of these dipolar molecules as one example, I have an induced dipole moment. I can change this dipole moment as I want. So I can see one first difference. Here I'm able not to change the charge, here I'm able to change the dipole moment. This at the end will allow me to sort of, from the outside, by inducing fields, induce very strong repulsive interactions between these molecules that at the end give me then the crystalline phase. And equally important, we have one of R cube down here, and this immediately applies the following. We have in Coulomb a long range 3D, and it's always repulsive. This kind of potential is only repulsive in 1D and 2D, so we need a trap, and the question is how stable is this thing, you know, when we sort of introduce a pancake trap. And the second important point I want to make clear is this, that a crystal, like the one over here with these ions, is always, you have to compare the potential energy with the kinetic energy for the given distance. This is the relevant parameter. This is potential energy, E squared divided by R, and R is, say, the mean distance. And this would be H bar squared divided by MR squared. This is the kinetic energy. And you can see that this parameter will be very much larger than 1. We get a crystal, in the case of Coulomb, for large distances, for very low densities. But here, we get this thing for high densities. So this means that if I start to take this molecular gas and sort of, you know, I start compressing and compressing, when these particles really want to get very close, which would be very bad in terms of collisions, all of a sudden they form a crystal. You know, so we can essentially stabilize phases that under normal conditions might be completely unstable, okay, because there would be collision encounters, okay, but we stabilize it, so to say, by the many-body physics that likes to form a crystal. I find this actually very exciting. So this is the reason why I see actually potential many applications. We can form a crystal at high densities before this, and but sort of switch off collisions at the same time. Then, of course, we can melt this thing. There's no way to melt in, these things in an ion trap. You cannot form a condensate of trapped ions. And you can think about now to what extent this Hamiltonian that you're writing down, like a 2D Hamiltonian with dipole-dipole interactions, is really valid. And just to indicate the stability of these things, you know, when I draw a phase like this, and it would be sort of a crystalline phase where we have small oscillations around here, in principle, there could be sort of a tunneling or a hopping where this thing would like to jump over into a configuration, strongly lowering its energy. Of course, we don't have any phonons in our system to induce real relaxation. No, this would have a much lower energy than something like this. This is repulsive. But actually, these two configurations are connected if you plot sort of a potential curves. You can see that if I put one molecule over here and I take the second one and sort of walk along here, this thing goes uphill, then there will be a saddle point, and then there will be a very deep minimum down here. Hans-Peter Büchler has done now calculations where he has estimated what the tunneling rate is for these things over here. And it turns out that, you know, that this tunneling rate has to do somehow with this sort of bouncing frequency that they have in this crystal configuration. Then it goes exponentially with this parameter RD that we introduced before, which has to be very large in the crystalline phase. So our statement is that, if you do sufficient 2D confinement, that we have all of the details here, then this tunneling and this instability is probably negligible, and we have a metastable phase of these crystalline arrangements talked about here. So I think that's a very important statement here. Well, sketch of the phase diagram. If I just sketch these things out, I'm really interested in crystal over here. Let me point out one important point. If I plot the function g of r, you know, this is a, I give you one molecule over here and I ask, where is my next one? Of course, if I have a solid or a crystal, of course, this thing would be like delta function peaks. If I have a liquid, it would sort of go like this. The important point in terms of atomic physics applications I really want to emphasize is the following. If I give you two objects, like maybe some highly excited molecules, that would be very, you know, that would have a finite lifetime and immediately decay if they have a close counter collision, you know. In a phase like this, you are keeping them apart. So it is really the many-body wave function that keeps particles apart. And so the particles by themselves may be highly unstable against some short encounter collisions. But of course, it is the many-body physics that keeps them a certain distance. And I think that for many of these molecular applications in the future, ideas like this will be very essential. In an optical lattice, of course, you're doing something like similar, but in a somewhat different context. So here would be some Monte Carlo simulations, seeing how the superfluid phase goes down with a certain parameter RD. This was this ratio of potential to kinetic energy. And at about 15, you have this phase transition forming eventually this crystal, which lives out here. And you can look at, for example, this function g of r. In 2D, we didn't really know how to do it because this is an angle average. But you can sort of see that this is the crystalline structure that you see, for example, in a 1D calculation coming out here that I indicated before. You can study these things now in a harmonic trap. You can see all of these shell structures. People know these things from ion traps, but there would be the possibility now of melting all of these shell structures and seeing this quantum phase transition between the superfluid and these crystalline phases here. I think it would be very exciting to see that, because in atomic physics, we don't have an example of something like this being possible. Then we can ask ourselves why. I'm sort of coming to the end quite soon. Sort of the comparison to be made is this, that we have here these self-assembled crystals where we engineer the interaction potential between the atoms or the molecules to build this kind of crystalline structures. And of course, as a competition, we have optical lattices. First of all, I would say that there's of course interest per se in studying these kind of crystalline phases now with atoms and molecules in the sense of studying these quantum phase transitions here in this context. It would be a new maybe very similar to the superfluid mode insulator ideas. that I mentioned before, we started here in 97, that has been sort of on the experimental side become a whole industry now, I would say. It would be, you know, exciting to see similar things here in these kind of experiments. And the important point is really to switch off destructive short-range interactions and collisions. And on the optical lattice side, of course, you would achieve something very similar by just having atoms like in a mod insulator and being on the adjacent lattice sides. You also switch off collisions because the optical potential keeps them apart. So in this sense, this would be somehow similar. But what's really important is the fact that the parameters are such that the lattice constants, don't forget that you form this lattice at very high densities, that these can be very small lattice constants, in particular in comparison with what you have on the side of the optical lattice. This is always tied to the laser wavelengths, and here we have the possibility of making lattices that are significantly smaller. And I think that it's, so it's like having a kind of a floating nanostructure. And mentioning, and also we would have phonons in the systems that you don't have in the optical lattice. I see interesting sort of applications here in the following sense. First of all, you can maybe take these triangular lattices that you have here and make some new kind of spin models here. You know, engineer, again, give them an internal degree of freedom. And then this game that we started before by talking about spin-spin interactions in an optical lattice, you know, we can sort of repeat these ideas now, but having a much smaller lattice spacing. So I think it looks very interesting by itself. But then you can even go one step further and ask yourself, okay, if you look at these curves here, this is like, you know, here is a dipole moment sticking out, here's one sticking out, here's one sticking out, and here. You can think, suppose that I take now an extra particle, like another molecule that has maybe a small dipole moment, and I let now these molecules sort of move in here. Now, at this point, we have sort of this self-assembled crystal, and we are now misusing it as a new kind of a periodic potential that has spacing, as I said before, much larger, hopefully, than the optical wavelengths. So all of the ideas about engineering Hubbard models and so on can now be repeated in this context here. But now, of course, we also have phonons, because this particle that sort of, you know, wants to tunnel through all of these things here, you know, it can kick, of course, the dipoles that make up this lattice. And so there will be phonons in the system. We never had phonons in the optical lattice here before. And if you ask yourself, if I give you an extra dipole and just put it in and let it move, what will it look like? Here is a one particle calculation for a wave function. If you make this potential relatively deep, you know, you can see that what emerges here will be a honeycomb lattice. These extra particles we put in will be a honeycomb lattice, and I would be very glad to understand, you know, if I take a honeycomb lattice like this, that I can do, for example, a Kedaev model. Now, you know, with this honeycomb lattice, which is sort of very naturally given by just being the dual lattice to the triangle lattice that we have over here. So I see this as a very promising, you know, way to make new lattice structure experimentally, hopefully at the end, and also a lot of new possibilities to engineer, you know, these interactions between them. So we can sort of take our old Hubbard ideas and then apply it in this new context, but there's many more new possibilities. And finally, you can also rethink all of that here in terms of bi- and multi-layer systems. Okay, here's some numbers. I stole this from one of my students, and I should, I guess, maybe stop in a few minutes from now. We also know how to do these things with Rydberg atoms, so maybe I just explained to you these things with my hands rather than looking at this very busy slide over here. If I give you an atom, suppose that I take some rubidium atoms, and suppose that I make a mod insulator, and I put now exactly one particle per lattice side. Now, in an atom, we have these highly lying Rydberg states up there. And if I apply an electric field, there will be a linear Stark effect. These dipole moments up there in these Rydberg states, they can be enormous. Okay, they scale like n squared, and n is the principal quantum numbers. And with the laser, what you can do is this, that you can, with the laser, weakly admix these huge dipole moments up there. So in this sense, you can construct an effective ground state of these atoms that have effective dipole moments, you know, by just weakly admixing the Rydberg state from up there. So I can sort of, you know, by switching on my laser, I can give these atoms now a dipole moment. Now imagine the situation that I have a mod insulator here, and I'm now switching with my electric field, you know, that I switch on, and also with my laser, I'm switching on the dipole moment, and I can, you know, give it a certain magnitude. I can maybe give it a magnitude in such a way that when I switch off the optical lattice, you know, maybe the level spacing sort of coincides with what the corresponding Wigner crystal will be like. So it becomes a problem like kind of the Frenkel-Kondorova problem. You have one lattice spacing and then the other one, and then you're sort of growing from a mod insulator phase, a crystalline phase. And this could be done with atoms. So I guess that people could, they have the right lasers, could even walk right now into the lab and try to do a crystal like that. There's a lot of things to be worked out. You know, what's the time scale, what's the decoherence times, and so on. But just want to claim that these numbers actually look not too bad. There would be some numbers here for polar molecules, which I don't really have time. There's questions of, you know, preparation. I just mentioned this, and also questions of how will you see a cell structure. We have some ideas of making like a microscope, or like it would rather be a telescope. You know, if I have a very small crystalline structure, you would like to ask questions like, can I image this thing? And very similar to the imaging that you do with lenses in optics, you can sort of pulse on laser fields in such a way to get a structure and sort of, you know, blow it up like a microscope. And this would be a way of actually measuring some of these cell structures here. Somebody is interested, I can explain this in more detail. Would be relation to ion trap quantum computing. And there would be another part over here that I don't really have time. If somebody is interested, I can explain to them how these models work for this molecular ensemble, then the circuit, cavity QID. We have a preprint on these things that I hopefully will submit over the next few days if there's convergence between all of these very famous co-authors here. You know, there's one person doing the hard work and the rest is the consultants. Okay, that's maybe a good time to stop here. Okay, so for me, sort of the deciding factor is always, you know, you take an experimentalist, a good experimentalist, of course, someone like David Mill here, you know, and you ask him, is it completely crazy if I, as a theorist, assume that in 2 years down the road you might have a mod insulator, you know, with polar molecules in the lab? And he says, yes, I can sort of, yes. And then if he says yes, then you say yes, okay? Okay? And so, I mean, all of these things have to be sort of, you know, reflected from experimentalists. And I would say that there's a kind of anomaly, a cupping. If these people see that they have a system where they might be able to do many of these things that are very interesting, that this becomes a very strong driving force. Like, I mean, the superfluid mod insulator ideas. I know when you wrote this paper here, it took about 3 years. And then when the experiment came, all of a sudden, everybody was extremely interested in all of these things. And then many groups sort of, you know, tried to do that. I think it will be similar here. People will make polar molecules, cold polar molecules, in the lab on the time scale of 2 or 3 years. And I think what we should do now is, independent of this fact, this will happen in some form. Yeah? The question is only, will they get the condensate or not? And I mean, what insulators, maybe a different question. But I can very clearly see that this will come. And I think that what we're doing is sort of this, to think ahead, given that they have these things, what can they do interesting in this condensed matter and quantum information context here? Yeah? So the final referee is always the experiments, I guess. You know, if experiments don't work, then all of this is completely irrelevant. Yeah? But I hope it's not the case.
Could I ask you a question? On, you mentioned phonons. In the ion traps, when they were doing bigger and bigger atoms for quantum information processing, they find, in fact, they have to start using shunting methods and so on. Now, so if you want to use optical lattice creators for quantum operations, give you noise?
Normally, but wait a minute. I see this like this, okay. I see in the context of the Hubbard model, these phonons as a very interesting additional feature that we do not have in the case of optical lattices. So if you want to talk about phonon physics in condensed matter physics, you can think about even cooling maybe your particles there by cooling the crystal and something like that. There's many important interfaces between this thing here. But if you talk very specifically about quantum computing, you know, you could sort of repeat ideas like, you know, take a string of ions and then you have these collective phonon modes and so on, and then you can do quantum computing by this phonon bus in the way that, you know, we proposed long time ago, and that in the meantime led to this really great experiment. But the point that I see is really a different. You would like to do a different kind of quantum computing if you really want to do it. I would take then a single polar molecule, then I'm asking myself how close to a strip line, for example, can I trap this thing? And there's been ongoing work. Hopefully there will be another paper quite soon submitted by the same group of people. So we were more the consultants and they were the ones that actively did this work, you know. Working out all of the trapping parameters, can I trap, for example, a single polar molecule with this dipole moment, maybe 100 nanometers above the strip line cavity? You get very strong stacking conditions, like, you know, you would have an on-chip trap, trap a single polar molecule, have this very strong dipole moment, and now you're just using the slip line cavity to do this communication over long distances. What was actually, I guess, called ultra long distance communication. The last week in the talk, okay.
Well, I think that's a beautiful idea, but I was really asking about what would happen if you build a Kitaev type lattice.
Okay. Here, I mean, what we showed is this, that we assumed that there was an optical lattice, yeah? And we had to make sure, you know, normally these dipole-dipole interactions can be very strong. But these optical lattices, you have to make sure there are certain things that come in, like when I do this kind of a coupling and I do the switching of my spin, that I do not excite the motion of this thing. This would be pretty bad. But of course, there's no phonons a priori in the optical lattice. This is really sort of a fixed thing. You know, if the particle oscillates, the back action on the laser is very small. So this is phonons essentially do not exist. But the decoherence comes in there that sort of, you know, while you flip your spins and you have the spin interactions, this might sort of entangle in a form that you don't like with the motion. But there's a set of inequalities that you have to satisfy in order to reach that. And so it simply means that the interaction should be much less at the level space than you have in an optical lattice. And somehow these numbers are not completely unreasonable. Yeah.
Compared to atomic optical lattice, where they propose to make also this honeycomb lattice interactions, can we get a better coupling regime?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know, the big problem with the atomic lattices is really this thing that I think I'm allowed to say that because there are many papers on this thing. So, is the time scale. You have tunneling. The tunneling, you sort of, you know, you got the tunneling, and then you have on-site interactions. We never have any off-site interactions except if you introduce dipolar couplings, like what we talk about here. And so when you start to engineer spin models, you always work on the exchange interaction. But this is like a P squared divided by U. Now, P is very small from the beginning. So the couplings become really quite small.
Well,
it's here, you know, you got these long-range electric, it's very important, bipolar interactions that I can manipulate with this microwave field, avoiding spontaneous emission from the excited state, you know, like in an alkali atom, you can think about using similar ideas optically, like what Gavin did in his thesis. But the problem at the end was obviously you get a lot of spontaneous emission. Okay, here the spontaneous emission on this microwave level does not exist, so many of these ideas work.
And the second question is, could we get a DC with polar molecules?
Well, if you switch off the dipole significantly, you want to make the kinetic energy much larger than the dipolar interaction energy. This is exactly the idea behind the melting here. You know, I can change the dipole moment externally. I can switch it on and off. If I make it very strong, you know, I'll get these crystalline phases where the potential energy is so large, it just locks and, you know, oscillates around the equilibrium, which is given by the external trapping potential. But if you make this thing very small, you know, you get this melting and then it will form a dipolar gas where these things move around, maybe avoid each other a little bit when they come too close, and then they will form a BC. There's a lot of papers out on dipolar BC, but we are talking about really the other extreme, that is crystalline phases that these papers have not really addressed so far.
Crystal dislocations are maybe some kind of classical analog for anions, so I was wondering, in the strategy you discussed to try to create artificial Wigner crystals of polar molecules. So there's possible.
Actually, there would not be a Wigner crystal because it's not one of R. So there would be just a crystal.
Right, triangular arrays of
polar molecules.
Presumably, these might form with defects in them. And I'm wondering whether you could actually hope to superimpose different geometric arrangements for polar molecules.
In principle, there's the following interesting possibility. For example, I can make here a lattice structure. You know, to suppose that each of these particles has internal spin, okay, qubit, spin up or spin down. I can, you know, depending on what the spin is, spin up or spin down, I can make a different dipole moment. So I can encode the spin and the dipole moment, and this dipole moment, of course, you know, if I give you a large and a small dipole moment, depending on the spin, this will induce in different interactions that would correspond to different crystal configurations even. So I see a lot of, you know, knobs that we can sort of turn here, but I haven't really thought about in any detail, you know, what how we can do these things here. But I see a lot of potential, so maybe I can talk about that afterwards.
I had a question regarding this picture. Are you worried at all about heating of the of this gas by the microwave?
Oh, no. So why would this cause heating?
Well, I guess in the microwave resonator, you have, in principle, you have some noise, electric noise from outside. Well, I don't know the numbers, so.
No, I mean, what people like to do is really that we think of something like calcium chloride, where you get a steel qubit. And we would never really couple directly to the excited state, so we will always feel resonance having Raman transitions. And so you never couple to the excited state. You know, you only couple the spin qubits down there. And you make, for example, you know, essentially what you do is this, that you got an ensemble, and suppose that you start out with all of the atoms which are down here in the lower spin set, okay? Suppose that your Cooper Bear box generates a photon that comes along in a microwave photon, okay? You can make a swap where one of these atoms, you know, flips the spin, making a transition to the other spin state that has maybe a slightly different energy in the sense of the Raman process, and you define in this way a qubit, which is where the zero of your qubit is all spin down, and the, so to say, one of your qubit is where one of them is flipped, but in a completely symmetric way, you don't know which one it is. Yeah? And all of this only involves manipulations where you never really couple to the excited states, you only couple virtually to some tuning. And so the only thing that I'm concerned with is that if you got a thermal ensemble at a certain temperature, then what will happen is this, that there will be a certain Doppler width associated with that, and you know there's conditions for the Raman tuning to be satisfied and all of these things, and this you have to put in the numbers. And the real question to be asked is this, is a collisional defacing of this qubit, what's the lifetime of the memory? There's no point in talking that's a great memory if at the end the lifetime, you know, is sort of comparable to the other elements that you have here. The statement is, depending on your temperatures, you know, something great would be 1 microkelvin, or if you go up to 1 millikelvin, the numbers are that you know that under a worst case scenario, the decoherence rate of this thing in the first case would be maybe something like 50 hertz. In the second case, 500 hertz, but it could be much, much better. This is sort of really a worst case scenario using unitary limit estimates for the collisions and so on. But it's a fairly complicated and log calculation. It depends on the different cross sections of these molecules, and you have to do some estimates for that. So I think this is actually a pretty good quantum memory. But I mean, the single molecules. Maybe I should make one comment. I mean, to what you said before. What I like about the single polar molecules relative to ions is this: the ions are based on using phonons for the exchange. You know, but this is, I don't know, megahertz, 10 megahertz, something like this. If you use the cavity, it gets to something like 10 gigahertz. All of these things about heating and so on of your polar molecules don't really are an issue here.
Oh, yeah. That's very nice.
Yeah, this is, I think that's all. So in this sense, this should work extremely well. I mean, experimentalists are challenged to build these traps.
Of course, but why single molecules instead of the ensembles for quantum computing? Just because
I'm very happy also with the ensembles, but I mean the ultimate thing is really that you want to have single molecules, you know, all of these games, like you can shuttle these things around also, and sort of a little bit of cleaner system, I think, molecules. At the end, I believe in the single atom qubit. Yes.
Your system is so rich that it is really difficult to find some existing analogies. But it seems to me that it's simpler from solid-state physics, are spatially indirect excitons in asymmetrical quantum wells. They are dipoles, and actually stable dipoles, oriented in the same direction. Mm-hmm. So that's a repulsion. So what is the most critical difference between your system and such non-direct excitons?
Okay. I'm not claiming here that we invented what a crystal is. Okay. And of course,
no,
And I mean, people have talked about bipolar crystals in the condensed matter context. I'm very aware of these things, and there's been a lot of work, I mean, over many, many years. I see the main point here that really that certain atomic and molecular physics features, you know, make these kind of phases that are new in this context very interesting and promising in a sense of, you know, apart from being able to study these quantum phase transitions in a time-dependent way, it would be interesting by itself, then in these various applications, you know, that you can really have a high-density phase where you keep objects that would, under close collisions, be, you know, decaying. You keep them apart, and therefore you stabilize a high-density phase. And so it's really like switching off peak coherence in an ensemble from these collisions at high densities. And so this is fantastic, you know. And so this feature that I feel, and so and the way how we achieve it is this, that nature doesn't give you these potentials between atoms or molecules that are repulsive in the first place, but we sort of, you know, put them in by maybe microwave fields, you know. For example, what we're doing at the moment is ideas like this. We can design a potential, I mean, polar molecules is one example, which is essentially zero for some distance, and then we can switch it on, like almost a hard curve of copotential V1 of R cubed. So if I give you a dilute gas to these molecules, they would be a BEC. But if I start compressing this thing, all of a sudden, you know, they will feel there's another part over here, then it will lock, and so you will make a phase transition to this crystalline phase by just compressing this thing. Yeah? And so it's like switching off the coherence once the high density is there. That's exactly what you want. Yeah? And we even have ideas how to do these things not only in 1D, 2D, but also maybe even in 3D. Ideas like this were done in laser physics a long time ago with alkaline atoms. They were called actually blue shields, but it never worked because of spontaneous emission. But here, if we take these old ideas, we can now recycle and think about the many body consequences of that. And so I see the application of these phases, in particular in this context of these atoms and molecules, it's a part that I'm really excited about. Yeah.
Yes, that's it.
If you want to have BEC from polarized atoms, is it essential to have strong microstone fields to keep the rotational line?
Yes. I mean, you ask it simply. I got the rotational spectrum here over here, and then I'm putting in an external field that induces a dipole moment, and you're saying, what's the ratio of my interaction, of my potential interaction with the external field relative to the rotational spacing. And there can be, of course, different limits. You know, I can induce a dipole, and if they're far apart, it would be aligned. If they come closer, at one point, you know, the dipole-dipole interaction may be stronger than this external field, and then, of course, they will lock into something like this. Yeah. This defines a certain radius, what you say, okay? So if I walk in, this will happen at a certain radius. And you have to ask yourself, where is this radius relative to the mean distance that I have, for example, in my crystalline phase? No, this gives you a certain distance. And I have to compare this distance that you talk about with the mean distance that I have. And so it's part of this study about the metastability. So we want an external strong field, but you know, this can actually vary in a relatively wide range. Did this answer the question, or you don't make?
I'm curious, if you have BEC, there should be some possibility of atoms get these polarized molecules getting rather close, so...
Or why would they get close? I mean, you know, they're like this, they really repel each other. If you don't allow that, no? This is what I talked about the stability. I mean, they come close as one of R cubed. So the normal BEC, of course, has this function G of R that we talked about, ideally would be just flat, it could be one. But here, of course, because of these interactions that we control externally, it's really zero, and then it goes up. You know, and there's these objects at the finite size, and you want to have that this going up to this function g of r is at the larger distance than the size of the object, and this would stabilize it. Then, okay.
There's no problem having long-range interaction when you want to have BEC.
You know, I'm not interested in BEC, but of course there will be sort of a kind of a bad BEC, like in the sense of helium. You know, you've got a certain depletion in your condensate, and the condensate fraction may be small. But as I said, you know, if you want a really great BEC, okay, it's just switch off the dipole moment, and you've got a fantastic BEC. But we're interested in the other limits.
Since this dipolar crystals, you're not going through the BEC and MOC transition route. You're not essentially, you're not having to use the fact that the molecules are indistinguishable. So does that help you at all, if they're slightly different and still you have to realize?
They're slightly different.
If the molecules are in slightly different states of some variables, you just say not relevant to the interactions that you want.
What do you mean by slightly different states? You mean internal states?
Yeah.
Well, we want to be in the rotational ground state. You know, and actually, you know, this energy, this is 10 gigahertz up. I mean, on the scale of the temperature of these systems, this is infinity. You know. No, I mean, I think that the way to prepare these things will actually be like, you know, in the molecule context, but also atom, make a mod insulator of the two species BC. Hopefully, you can do this photo association where you take the energy out with the laser, you go all the way to the ground state. And then you have this cold ensemble mock insulator of polar molecules, and if you want, just melt it now. Okay, switch off the optical lattice and Normally there will be, you know, there will be ground state collisions with you have cold gas, but now if you, you know, you will get these phases there. So I see this is a way of preparing that. That's very important.
But we see this for PCs.
Well, we always are playing the same, that we downgrade now PC as being a tool for something else we want to do.
Okay, so maybe further discussion should be private.